Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is The Daughters of Kobani and Women's Empowerment in Syria. With me to discuss how a women's militia helped lead the fight against the Islamic State in Syria is Gail Zamak-Limone. Gail is an adjunct senior fellow for women in foreign policy at the Council. She is the author of the New York Times bestsellers, Ashley's War and The Dressmaker of Kerkana. Her newest book, The Daughters of Kobani, A Story of Rebellion, Courage, and Justice, was released today. Gail, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I want to congratulate you, Gail, on publication of The Daughters of Kobani. Some of the early reviews have been extremely positive. I'll note that Kirkus Reviews calls it a well-told story. Publishers Weekly says it enthralls and informs. And Library Journal says that this is a story that needed to be told and needs to be heard. So congratulations.
Thank you so much. It means a lot.
I want to talk about the book and the issues you address there. And I have to begin by noting that The Daughters of Kobani is a multifaceted story. It's in part a story about the successful effort to push the Islamic State out of Syria. It is also a story about ethnic minority Kurds who've long been suppressed by the government in Damascus, trying to protect their communities and win a say over governance of their communities. And it's also a story about women's empowerment as Kurdish women form a militia to liberate their people while running roughshod over cultural taboos that heavily circumscribe what women can do. But before we dive into all of those various threads, I'd like to begin our conversation with where you begin the book with the question of why you wrote another book about war and its consequences. I had expected you to write a different book after your previous two books, and you note in your introduction that after writing Ashley's War, you felt emotionally spent trying to make Americans care about faraway places and people that meant so much to you personally. You were tired of living two lives, one at home and one immersed in war. What persuaded you to change your mind?
This was just an absolutely extraordinary story that stayed with me after I heard it, and I really wanted to understand this whole notion that we talk about really in The Daughters of Kobani's opening, as you so eloquently put it, is every great story starts with a question you can't answer. And I wanted to understand how it was that one of the most far-reaching experiments in women's equality had taken place right on the ashes of the fight against the Islamic State, created by women who fought ISIS room by room, house by house, town by town for a half decade as America's partner on the ground. And it just created all of these questions in my mind, and I wanted to understand how this had come to be and why we didn't know these people.
Let's talk a bit about the people that form the core of the story that you tell, Gail. There are a number of people who appear across the story that you tell: Azima, Rojda, Nowruz. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Yes. So you're talking about the women who led the fight against ISIS, all of whom were America's interlocutors in the fight to stop the physical caliphate of the Islamic State. You have Azima, who's kind of this swashbuckling persona. The Americans actually had told me ahead of time before I ever went to Syria that I had to meet her. And the book really opens with one of the young soldiers in Ashley's War calling me and saying, you have to come to Syria. You have to see what is happening here, because the people we're working with on the ground to fight ISIS also are women. And she was astounded by that as well. And so Azima was somebody she had pointed me to, and many others had said, you know, if you want to meet one of the women who is leading the fight against ISIS, you have to meet her. You know, ISIS at one point had tried to shoot her, had tried to kill her, and she just kept going. She was never going to be deterred by the men of the Islamic State. Then you had Znarin, who had been on her own journey, which I think many women would understand. If her family said, you know, your choice about education doesn't conform with what we want for you. Your choice about who to marry doesn't conform with what we want for you. And then here she is, through a series of circumstances, many of which were out of her control, ending up on the global stage, leading the fight against ISIS. And then you have Rojda, who was kind of quiet. I sometimes joke because she and Azima actually had grown up together. And she was sort of the Beth of Little Women versus Joe character of Azima, who has a very larger than life persona. And Rojda, I think, is such an interesting warrior because she's very quiet. She's much more introverted, loves to read books, loves to watch Brazil in soccer, and yet could talk with real connection and proximity about ISIS and what it was like to put her weapon in the wall in Kobani and hit the leg of an Islamic State fighter. And it was that mix of humanity and who they were. You know, there's a moment in the story where actually Rojda's mother calls during the Battle of Kobani and she just puts her phone up to listen to the bullets whiz by because she didn't want to not answer her mother's call. And it was that mix of war and humanity and women fighting for equality that I just thought, you know, I cannot not tell this story. It's a huge privilege to be able to do so.
I must say, Gail, that scene in the book where you describe getting the phone call from the mother checking on how you were doing just sort of doesn't seem to fit with other descriptions we've seen of war.
Yes.
But it brings in a real sort of human element, and it also just touches on how much technology has changed. But I'm sort of curious, can we take a step back before these women joined their militia? Can you sort of talk about sort of the situation that not just they as women, but they as Kurds in Arab-dominated Syria face, and sort of give us the context for the situation that they worked within?
Yeah, so you couldn't really talk about 2011 and the start of the Syrian civil war in the Kurdish community without also looking at 2004. And there's a confrontation between, you know, regime forces and the Kurds that starts with a soccer match.
This is the regime of Bashar al-Assad.
That's right. The Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad, just a couple years after he's actually taken power after his father dies. And so 2004, Kurds are shot at, unarmed Kurds are shot at. Many are later, and protests that ensue are rounded up, arrested, tortured. And there is this sense that we can't let this happen again. 2011 comes, the Syrian civil war starts with a very peaceful protest that the regime answers with barbarity. And it escalates from there. And the Kurds are watching warily because while they are not friendly to the Assad regime, they're also deeply concerned about what would come next. And in that vacuum of the Syrian civil war, these people's protection units, it turns out that this group of Syrian Kurds who follow Abdullah Öcalan end up being the most organized. And they are able to quickly implement checkpoints to bring some level of security and to, you know, really take charge in this corner of northeastern Syria as the Syrian civil war starts to bring true chaos and the fight is really enveloping their community. And they really, you know, one thing that was so fascinating, Jim, in talking to these women is that they never thought they would be fighting the Islamic State at the beginning. It was really, you know, protect your neighborhood, protect your town, protect your family's house, you know, from outsiders.
Okay, so you've just added another layer of complexity here, Gail, in this story. And I must say it is marvelous how you weave in the various elements of the story because it is quite complex. So you begin with Kurds living in northeastern Syria. They're an ethnic minority. They've been repressed by the government in Syria. But you've just introduced another character, which is Abdullah Öcalan, who is Turkish Kurd, who has led a movement to liberate Kurds in Turkey. He spent a number of years living in Damascus because the Syrians and the Turks are at odds. So can you give us the broader geopolitical context for this? Because it becomes very important to the events that unfold subsequently.
Sure. So the Syrian regime is doing anything it can to hold on to power. And as the Syrian civil war morphs from a peaceful protest into an armed conflict, into really the flame that attracts extremist groups to fight it and to really hijack what had begun as a peaceful protest, you see all of these geopolitical pieces come into play. Iran comes in on the side of the Syrian regime. It is absolutely committed. Russia comes in on the side of the Syrian regime. It's absolutely committed. Turkey's on the other side, as it has been often from Syria. And then a number of other players come in hoping to see the Assad regime topple. Into all of this, the group on the Kurdish side, you know, who have this ethnic minority that's very warily watching what is happening. And the people who are most organized to mobilize governance are these group of Syrian Kurds who very few people from the outside had heard of, who follow Abdullah Öcalan, who after years and years in Turkish prison is really writing about grassroots participatory democracy with social ecology or, you know, environmental awareness at its center and women's equality at its heart, with this whole idea that the Kurds couldn't be free until women were free. And so the ideology that has this notion of women's equality, along with environmental awareness, lack of hierarchy, all comes from the thoughts that Abdullah Öcalan is sharing from prison. And a lot of these young women are reading this and it resonates with them, right? This whole notion that women have rights and that they have equal rights. And as they form these people's protection units early on in the Syrian civil war just to protect their own neighborhoods. In 2013, a group of women say, we're going to form women's units too. And there's a moment, Jim, when you try to figure out, is this a book? And I was interviewing Rosha for hours on end. And I finally said, you know, why did you start these women's protection units? You already had, according to your ideology, you had equality. You already had the ability to lead men in battle, which they were already doing, and to fight alongside men. And she looked at me and she said, we just didn't want men taking credit for our work.
I think a lot of women hear something very truthful in that, Gail.
Yes, there's something deeply universal about that notion. And so all of these forces come together, and then comes the Islamic State. And then the whole world starts to pay attention to this slice of Syria and what is happening.
Just to close the loop on the geopolitical context. So Öcalan, who had spent almost 2 decades in Syria, is captured in Africa, I believe with the help of the United States, and he is imprisoned by the Turks. He was originally sentenced to death, and then Turkey abolished the death penalty, but he continues to write from prison, and his own views evolve. And there's a short sub-story in your book which ties Öcalan to a former communist turned almost new age.
Yeah, turned social ecologist.
named Murray Bookchin, who writes a book called The Ecology of Freedom. And so if you just sort of fill us in about that little connection.
He's a fascinating, fascinating person. And reading his work and talking to his family, it was completely illuminating. So Murray Bookchin was this, you know, really fascinating person who had grown up with an immigrant experience in New York from a Russian family, had been shaped by communist ideas early on, becomes disenchanted with that around the period of World War II, and then really turns to the notion that after anarchy, that you could have this grassroots participatory democracy, almost like New England style town hall meetings. And in fact, he moves from New York to Vermont. And his former wife actually is to the left of Bernie Sanders, fights Sanders on a waterfront development project.
This is when Sanders was mayor of Burlington, Vermont, correct?
That's correct. And Murray Bookchin is putting out these ideas that are well ahead of his time about worrying about the environmental impact of corporate policies, worrying about the lack of sharing of natural resources, worrying about hierarchy leading to social conflict, income inequality leading to social conflict. And he writes this book that you were talking about, right? And he then is read by Öcalan in prison. And they put these ideas together of Kurdish liberation plus Bookchin's thoughts, all that Öcalan has been writing, that now the Kurds actually don't need a state. What they need is self-governance, local autonomy to be able to rule themselves according to their precepts and according to their governance ideals. And at the heart of that is grassroots participatory democracy from some of the Bookchin writings, with ecology at its center and women's rights right at the heart of it. And all of these ideas are now center stage as the United States looks for a partner in the fight against the Islamic State.
And in political terms, though, the Turks still regard Öcalan as an enemy. The organization he led, the PKK, is a terrorist threat. And they see the Kurdish militias in Syria as simply an extension of the PKK and hence a threat to Turkey, correct?
That's correct. That is the Turkish view.
Okay, that is the Turkish view. So now we have these militias form, and you have an incredibly gripping story about the battle for Kobani. And maybe you could sort of just explain a little bit about the battle and why it was significant and what happened.
To talk about the Battle of Kobani, we almost have to rewind the clock to 2014 and remember how frightened the entire world was of the Islamic State and how out of ideas they were about how they were going to counter ISIS. So you have, and the book really does go into the American side of this, looking at the policy conversations going on, looking for this, the Americans looking for this Goldilocks, right? A force that was capable of taking terrain from ISIS and advancing while not toppling Assad, because the Obama administration deeply felt that it had been elected to end wars in the Middle East, not to start.
And not send U.S. troops on the ground into places like Syria.
Above all else, right? No U.S. boots on the ground. And so they needed a ground force that was actually capable of doing it. Summer of 2014, ISIS has had no battlefield losses. They are just on a tear. They are making their videos. They are storming across Iraq and Syria. They've taken Mosul. They are just absolutely cutting a swath of land that they want to shape in their name, bringing terror, abductions, explosions, kidnappings, rape, enslavement of people, all of that with them. And then comes the battle for Kobani. And it's this small town on the Turkish border. You can literally put out your arm and be in Turkey when you're there. And the People's Protection Units, right, these Kurdish militia that had been formed years earlier in the start of the civil war, really makes its stand against ISIS. And because of its proximity to Turkey, and because cameras can capture what is happening, and because no one is willing to help them, their tenacity, their fight, their willingness to fight to the death against the Islamic State becomes this David versus Goliath story. And David is also a woman because you have these women who are very much a part of the battle. And it captures the attention of the Americans who already have been speaking with them, who are saying, wait a minute, maybe these people who are putting up this fight, which is now being captured on CNN and seen on social media, maybe they offer us a shot at a ground force that is willing to fight ISIS.
I should note that the Islamic State almost overruns Kobani, and it is because of these militias that they are turned back, and it's the first defeat they really face, and it sort of ends the growth, at least in Syria, to the going west of the Islamic State. And that really changes the calculations of the Obama administration, perhaps more accurately, people in the Obama administration. Maybe you can sort of talk about what then happens, because there was a lively debate in the administration over what to do and who to do it with.
And likely to be continued into the Biden administration, mm-hmm. right, with many of the same people.
We'll come back to that.
And then the debate forms inside the Obama administration as they're looking for a ground force, right? Who is going to stop the Islamic State? And debate forms between many folks in the State Department who say, listen, we cannot work with the People's Protection Units, even if they're fighting ISIS, because of our NATO ally, Turkey, and how they view these people. And then they are met with another group led by a number of diplomats who then go on to become front and center in this, who say, and folks on the military side who say, listen, this is the best shot we have. You know, we've met these people. We understand them. They are bringing the fight to ISIS. They are holding terrain. They're doing things that even U.S. forces would likely find it very difficult to do. And they're doing it with will, which we can't emulate. And so this is our best shot. Let's try it with them. And that debate starts in 2014 and plays out throughout the Battle of Kobani. And the Americans come in on the side of the Syrian Kurds, who are kind of in this David position against ISIS, which is much better armed, much better trained, and on a tear and on a string of victories. And the Americans come in on their side to support them from the air. Slowly, not as powerfully as I had initially thought before I started really doing the research for this book. And even while they're launching these strikes, actually U.S. officials are saying it's very likely that air power won't be enough, right? Kobani might still fall. And when you talk to the people who are part of this story, you know, and readers really go inside this battle in the book, they were down to basically a block by the end of it.
But they win. And that's the
important. And it's a huge turning point, both for them and the United States.
Well, walk us through the turning point. What happened subsequently? Because there are several other battles which you feature in the book. And I don't think we're telling people they don't already know, because we know that the Islamic State at the end of the day has been defeated, at least as a territorial entity, not necessarily as an ideology. But just sort of walk us through sort of the arc over the next several years.
So the bubble of invincibility is punctured by the battle for Kobani. And that is what comes out in the interviews I did, particularly on the U.S. side, but also on the Syrian side, which is that once they see that ISIS can be defeated, right, that they actually can be handed a battlefield loss, it hurts their ability to recruit, sort of punctures some of the larger than lifeness of their, you know, what they are undertaking. And so all of that comes to play. The battle for Kobani happens, they win. And then there are folks on the American side who think, wait a minute, this might be just the start of how we go from town to town to retake the territory that the Islamic State has gone. And the larger the threat that ISIS starts to pose to Europe and to the United States in these years, 2015, 2016, the more pressing it becomes to take that terrain back. And the more successful these women and the men that they fight alongside are in actually holding the terrain and then putting in place governance structures, the more the Americans think, okay, wait, we can work with these folks and they are our partner.
And the United States pushes these militias to form a broader political coalition, in part to allay the concerns of the Turks about empowering Kurds in Syria. And there's also a significant role played by U.S. special operators. We want to talk a little bit about sort of the people you talked to, because I know you talked to a lot of people besides people who actually show up in the story itself, but maybe give us some sense of how the U.S. special operators regarded this militia force or forces they were working with.
You know, I think the best way to capture how they felt was I spoke with one special operations soldier. All the folks I talked to had really spent 12, 13, 14, 15 deployments in the post-9/11 conflicts. These were men and some women who knew a lot of war. And one of them told me about this moment where he's watching this flatbed truck of 25 young women who are going off to fight ISIS in the town of Shadadi. And they're all in there kind of hugging each other in the morning, getting right at the rally point, at the meeting point. And some of them have flowers in their hair. All of them have AK-47s. friends, and they're, you know, sort of have that spirit of, you know, they're about to go take the fight to ISIS. And he has this mix of jealousy that U.S. policy means that he can't go to the front because there weren't going to be no U.S. boots on the ground, respect for the warriors that they are, awe at sort of the kind of motivation that they have, shame in some ways because he feels like he should be doing more. He who knows a lot of war should be going with them to help. And a real sense, as he said to me, I kept thinking of the MacArthur speech, duty, honor, country. And I think that really sums it up to me. These were, you know, another special operations soldier said, we were tired of losing and tired of watching ISIS win. And we met this force that happened to have women, you know, in it the first time for most of them. In fact, I didn't think anybody I met had actually worked with women in a partner force in their career. And yet they just kept coming back to this, their notion of kind of a warrior ethos that they shared of getting the job done and stopping the Islamic State, which was what they were after. And the book really chronicles, I think, their quest also to get U.S. policy to match what they were seeing on the ground.
I want to pull in this thread about the Islamic State. Obviously, the Islamic State had a very different view of women and women's role. They were quite oppressive. And you detail many atrocities they committed against women in Syria and Iraq, particularly against the Yazidis. But the other part of your story is about these militias, which want to put front and center the idea of women's equality. Equality and women's empowerment. Can you sort of play that out for me? These are in essentially same communities, but violently different views of the role of women.
I was so compelled by this notion that every day for a half decade, two very different worldviews had collided on the battlefield. One which said women could be bought and sold and enslaved in some of the worst crimes against humanity that we have not even begun to reckon with. And I give just a huge urge to people to read Nadia Murad's book and others on this topic. So you have that worldview. And then it comes up against, you know, what are the chances that the people they come up against not only are fighters, but there are also women fighters. And those women fighters are not just fighting for their neighborhoods, but right at the heart of what they do is we can't be free as Kurdish people, as Kurds, until women are free. And their notion, they weren't looking to make friends or win people over. They were looking to show through what they did, through their actions, that there was nothing women could not do. And as one of the women who led this all-women's force said to me, if we would win in the war, we would govern in the peace.
The book covers all the way up through the Battle of Raqqa, which was a pivotal battle in the defeat of the Islamic State. And the militias you describe are at the forefront of achieving that victory. But the story doesn't end with the defeat of the Islamic State at Raqqa. So perhaps you could tell us a little bit about what transpired after that.
So after the battle for Raqqa comes Deir ez-Zor, comes Baghouz, and this really apocalyptic stand that ISIS makes, where it will not let its followers leave this last stand that they are going to make. And I interviewed mothers who came out of that last stand just crying, saying that, you know, whose husbands belong to the Islamic State, who themselves belong to the Islamic State, saying, you know, my children were crying for water, for juice, for anything for months, and yet the leaders of the Islamic State had all of those things and more and left us to suffer. And so this, you know, the Baghouz happens, and then there's this ceremony. And all of the people who are part of this story end up at this ceremony where the U.S. officials are there. The Star Spangled Banner is played by a band, and readers really enter this story and kind of attend this with them. And U.S. officials can speak. And this question of what happens in the future hangs over it. And then only months later, Turkey and Turkish-backed forces launch an incursion into this territory. And some of the women we met who've been fighting ISIS and fighting to liberate towns, including Ayn Issa, from the Islamic State, then go back to those towns to defend them against the Turkish-backed incursion.
Well, the Turkish-backed incursion occurs because President Trump essentially gives a green light to Turkey to move across the border. And that, of course, raises, you know, policy questions of where we go from here. And I note you begin your epilogue by saying the future of northeastern Syria remains a question written in invisible ink in the language no one can yet decipher. I think that's true, but could you sort of help us think through, Gail, where you see this going and particularly what challenges you see for the Biden administration?
So I actually was in a northeastern Syria in December after that. And I have to say, I was so, I always joke, I'm much more hopeful in northeastern Syria than in northwest Washington.
Okay.
And that was even the case then, because even with everything that had happened, there was this spirit of, okay, we still have many of the gains we've made. We're still going to work work for this multi-ethnic, multi-religious area that we have, this slice of land that we have. And even in Raqqa, which is nominally controlled by Russia and the regime, and in Kobani, which the Russians are patrolling, all of the governance that had been placed was still there, right? Every town is led by a council that has a male head and a female head in the civil council. In the women's councils are in every town. Those are still up and running. So it was much more enduring than I had ever expected to see. It points to the durability of what they're seeking to create in northeastern Syria and what the book is really talking about. And so all of that said, the Biden administration now faces the same questions it did when many of its members were there under the Obama administration, which is, how do we commit to the ISIS fight if we do? With whom? And as the Syrian regime and really Russia has shown itself not terribly capable of getting at and diminishing the Islamic State's ability to launch attacks. If you look at what's happening right now in this moment, attacks are on the rise. A Deir ez-Zor is facing at nighttime a resurgent Islamic State. And the SDF, right, the forces that the U.S. partnered with, right, become the partner who is still taking the fight to ISIS, even as it is trying to keep this very fragile stability it created in the aftermath of the ISIS fight. And the Biden administration is really going to face the same choice the Obama administration did, which is stay committed to this partner in fighting the Islamic State with the most effective fighting force against ISIS, which has shown that its governance structures can endure, or hear what Turkey is urging it to, which is move away from your support for these people.
Any sense of where the Biden administration is likely to lean?
I don't know that. What I do know is that you have voices who were most articulate and who were part of the Daughters of Kobani, right? Brett McGurk, who is now inside. There are others on the diplomatic side who were very articulate advocates for why the SDF, why the People's Protection Units, why the Syrian Kurds were the best partner for the United States. Also going back in are people who were opposed to that in 2014. But I do think that this is the fault line that we'll see. It is a fault line that has returned, but the most articulate backers of why this made sense for the United States in keeping the pressure on ISIS and in growing stability in the region are now returning to the fore.
Gail, I'm curious, when readers finish the Daughters of Kobani and put it down, and I will tell you it's hard to put it down, what do you hope they will take away from reading the book?
I hope they're inspired. I hope they're inspired by people who don't give up, even against the odds, because they are really fighting for something that is bigger than themselves, and that they have taken the fight to ISIS and refuse to back down in the name of all people, including women. And this is really a moment in the United States, in around the world, when we're rewriting the rules that govern our lives. And that is what, in the end, so much of this story is about. And it is so interesting for me, Jim. So my father is from the region, and it's the first time I've ever written about this. But, you know, there is a view that really says that it's confounding the notion that women are equal. And when you see what they are putting into place on the ground, however you feel about it, you see that it's different. When you see women in power and holding power, it looks different, especially when you're talking about fighting extremists, fighting ISIS, fighting men who have no value for women and who actually do put the enslavement of women right at the center of their worldview.
I thought there was a lovely, touching observation by one of the women you interviewed, and it went as follows. We are trying to build a little lake in the middle of the desert.
Yes, that was from one of the political leaders who said, you know, it's not easy and it doesn't happen quickly. But what we're trying to do is to build a haven for rights and for people to be able to exercise who they are in the middle of war. And I think that is one theme that has come through all the stories I've had the privilege of writing, which is that war brings horror, but it also creates openings for women. And that was very much the case in this story.
On that point, I'm going to close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Gail Zamok-Lamon, Adjunct Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Her new book, The Daughters of Kobani, A Story of Rebellion, Courage, and Justice, is out now. I should note that a production company run by Hillary and Chelsea Clinton have bought the rights to The Daughters of Kobani to turn it into a television series. And I should also note that Gail's earlier New York Times best-selling book, Ashley's War, has been optioned by Universal films to make a movie out of it. So Gail, again, congratulations on an excellent book. Congratulations on the success of your work.
Thank you so much, Jim. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Please subscribe to The Presence Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in The Presence Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.